TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of useful consciousness.
The WTO and the destruction of the environment. Patty Goldman and Stephen Schreibman. This is the first half of a one-hour program on the impact the World Trade Organization has had on the environment. The acceleration of trade in the last 5 years has led to an alarming depletion of land, water, and forests. Also, the WTO rules are used to strike down environmental protection laws and agreements in all member countries, including the U.S. Patty Goldman is head of the Northwest Office of the Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund. She was the key lawyer in fashioning the first lawsuit against NAFTA. She tried to force the then Bush administration to prepare an environmental impact statement to disclose what NAFTA was really going to do to us and the Earth. Most recently, she brought a successful suit against the U.S. Trade Representative, challenging the exclusion of anybody but corporations from the Industrial Sector Trade Advisory Committees, which the Trade Representative operates. Based in Seattle, Patty Goldman helped organize the successful protests in that town during the WTO ministerial meeting. Patty Goldman.
I've spent nearly 20 years as a lawyer trying to obtain strong health and environmental protections in this country and then trying to get them enforced. It's always been hard work because there are moneyed interests, well-connected moneyed interests on the other side every time. But it is nothing compared to trying to defend those laws when they're challenged before the World Trade Organization. The WTO is putting trade ahead of people and the planet. This bias is evident in how the WTO operates. The decision makers are trade officials, not environmental ministers, not health officials, trade ministers. They meet in secret. They do not get input from the public, from interested non-governmental organizations. Non-governmental organizations cannot be part of the proceedings, which is a contrast to the way almost all other international institutions work. And when disputes arise, they're decided by three trade experts who meet in secret. The bias is also written directly into the WTO rules. And it's important to realize this is a system of rules. They would fill many phone books. Every country has bound itself to follow these rules. And if a country does not, then it can face trade sanctions until it complies. I want to give some examples of the rules that are hostile to environmental protections. First, the WTO does not allow countries to restrict trade because goods are produced in a way that harms the environment, because the forests have been logged in a way that degrades water quality, or the fish are caught in an unsustainable manner. The WTO requires that there be no discrimination against products, but it defines a product only when it's in commerce. In the WTO's eyes, it doesn't matter what happens beforehand when the forests are cut or the fish are caught, or what happens afterwards when it's time to dispose of that product. Under this principle, the United States has been told that it cannot block imports of tuna that have been caught in a way that killed and maimed dolphins. The United States has been told it can't block imports of shrimp that are caught in ways that don't have protections for sea turtles so they don't drown in the nets. And the United States is using these rules to tell Europe that it should not ban toxic chemicals in computers. The toxic chemicals create toxic waste sites, and that is why Europe wants to ban them and wants to make the computer companies responsible for the waste. But the United States is saying, the United States is saying that the WTO doesn't allow Europe to do that, that we are not exposed to those chemicals when we sit in front of our computer. The product doesn't hurt us when we're using it. So Europe should not be able to ban the chemicals because they might later create toxic waste. And unfortunately, Europe has already started to back down. In the latest proposal, fewer toxic chemicals are part of the ban. The threats have had some success. The timber industry has invoked the WTO to try to gut an eco-label. Europe was putting together an eco-label on paper. And the timber industry said the label shouldn't tell us how the paper is produced, because the WTO doesn't allow that. And the United States did the industry's bidding and told Europe that it would discriminate against the United States to label the paper based on whether it's recycled or not, because we log our forest to create paper, and then some of our paper might be disadvantaged in the marketplace. There's another set of rules that stands in the way of health and environmental protections. The WTO does not recognize what's called the precautionary principle. It might be best understood as the old adage, better safe than sorry. And you heard José Bové describe the Europeans' desire to apply that principle and ban hormones in beef. And the WTO said Europe went too far. And let me tell you why. The hormones have been shown to cause cancer in animals, but the WTO wanted evidence that they would cause cancer to people when they're eaten. We don't generally do those kinds of tests on people. We don't usually wait for that kind of proof. But the WTO wanted more definitive proof that people would be harmed when they ate the beef. And the other thing that the WTO said is Europe had to prove the beef was harmful. And this is in contrast to the United States or the cattle industry having to prove that the beef would be safe. And this is a huge area of controversy in toxics controls and food safety. The struggle is often over who has the burden of proof and who's going to bear the risk. In this country, we've often put the burden on public health. We have a lot of chemicals on the market while they're undergoing studies to see if they're truly safe. And there are some times when we've been successful here and elsewhere in saying, no, we're going to put the proof on the other side. We will not allow exposure until we know this is safe. And let me give you an example. I mean, years ago, thalidomide was marketed for morning sickness. And it was on the market in Europe, and there were tragic birth defects in babies as a result. But in this country, we had a strong pre-market approval system and a brave scientist in the government who said there isn't enough evidence of safety. And we were spared that tragic instance here. The WTO requires that you have that proof of harm, though, up front. These same rules hamper a country's ability to guard against invasive pests. And this could be the biggest threat to our forests in this country. Is critters that would come in on traded goods and cause an epidemic in our forests. Our amount of imports that are coming in have increased in the last decade by huge amounts. And the first time we regulated to try to keep out invasive pests was in 1995. Environmentalists went to court and challenged the regulation, saying it didn't go far enough. And the U.S. government said the WTO keeps us from having more stringent regulations. But under the WTO, we need to have evidence that the pests are already here before we can act to keep them out. The WTO also insists that a country use the least trade restrictive way to protect public health or the environment. A ban is always more restrictive than limitations on use. Limitations on use are more restrictive than mandatory labeling. And mandatory labeling is more restrictive than voluntary labeling. And I've seen every single one of those arguments made. The WTO's threat to the environment is not hypothetical. In less than 5 years that the WTO's been around, it has repeatedly collided with the environment, and every time, the environment has lost. The environmental community is calling on the WTO to rework its rules, to rework the way it operates in a hugely significant way so that strong environmental and health standards will no longer be at risk. The WTO has already staked out its ground, though. It has predetermined the outcome of many of the significant environmental issues of our day, and it did that without any of us being part of that debate. It did that in secret. Did that with trade officials making the call. And we need to start over. We need to have an open dialogue, a participatory dialogue that brings people together and make these decisions where they're closest to the people affected, not in Geneva. A recent survey in the United States found that 74% of the people surveyed favored restricting trade to protect the environment. Now, it may be when we have a dialogue and we bring people together to come to solutions, we may have a whole different way of operating. We may require the rich countries of the North to share their wealth with the South so that we can upgrade all of our environmental standards. We may require technology transfers and financial assistance, but that's what we need. That's what we need if we're going to have environmental protection and bring environmental standards up. The WTO is pushing us on a race to the bottom, and that is not acceptable. Well, let's hope this is the beginning of the dialogue and a time of change so that we put ourselves on a new course and bring environmental standards up and make sure that our trading system protects people and the planet. Thank you.
That was Patty Goldman, head of the Northwest Office of the Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund in Seattle. The next speaker is Stephen Schreibman, executive director of the West Coast Environmental Law Center in Vancouver, Canada. He campaigned against the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, the MAI, and the WTO. Here is Stephen Schreibman.
I have a title for my talk, which is the WTO, the best thing to ever happen for the environment. And thank heaven for those trade cases. This is to those of you who have been waiting for the revolution. Some of you for many years, I won't ask you to identify yourselves. Well, I have good news and I have bad news. The good news is that the revolution is finally here. But wait. The bad news is that it isn't our revolution yet. Because that's really how the WTO needs to be understood. It represents nothing less than a revolutionary transformation of the trade regimes that preceded it. Not evolutionary, but revolutionary, both in terms of scope, and you've heard many speakers describe just the breadth of its application. And perhaps the best example occurred when your government and my government went to European consumers and said on our behalf, you do not have the right to consent when it comes to the food you eat. It doesn't get much more personal than that. But it was also revolutionary in another important sense, and that was to write into a trade regime which, until 1995, existed to facilitate the negotiated consensual resolution of trade disputes, enforcement mechanisms more powerful than had ever been created in any domestic or international legal regime in the world. When you find yourself out of bounds with your obligations to submit to the disciplines of international trade agreements, you face trade sanctions in the order of hundreds of millions of dollars for every year you remain in non-compliance. That is a price that not even the wealthiest nations on earth can afford. Now, all of this happens at a particularly auspicious moment, because if we care to or dare to, we can actually stare into the ecological abyss. We can listen, and only if we take half seriously the warnings that are coming from an increasingly grave chorus of scientific opinion, that we face some rather daunting challenges. We must reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and I suspect this is a conservative estimate, by something in the order of 60%, merely to stabilize levels of carbon concentration in the atmosphere at levels that we haven't seen on this planet for more than 100,000 years. And we don't have the dimmest idea what that means for our ecosystem. We can speculate and guess, and many of the speculations are terrifying. All we know is the risks couldn't be higher. A survey conducted by the American Museum of Natural History of 400 biologists in the United States discovered that the majority of them believed that we were well in the process of the sixth great mass extinction of life on Earth, this one caused by man. And so we have the convergence of these two agendas, these two very disparate realities, these increasingly difficult to ignore ecological imperatives and trade rules. And we can observe the collision between these two dynamics very readily in the trade disputes that have been nominated to challenge Clean Air Act regulations in the United States, marine mammal protection laws here, food safety regulations in Europe, export controls in Canada, and an increasing number of environmental and conservation initiatives, every single one of which has fallen when caught in the crosshairs of international trade dispute resolution. It's not as easy to observe in the negotiations that are taking place around multilateral environmental agreements like the Biodiversity Convention. Most Canadians don't know that Canada has used trade arguments to frustrate proposals to build into the Framework Convention on Climate Change enforcement provisions that would mean that governments actually began to take seriously the commitments, the solemn commitments they made when they signed on to that convention. Some are a little harder to understand, the ways in which trade rules fundamentally undermine our capacity to develop the economic, industrial, and trade policies that are the necessary platform for sustainable patterns of development. Trade policies that remove our ability to constrain unregulated foreign demand to water, to unprocessed resources, that say to communities, we have access to your markets and access to your resources, and you can't tell us how to go about conducting our affairs, and you can't require that we invest in your communities. It is even harder to understand in the ways in which trade rules entrench a model of development that accelerates our speed along a course which leads to an ecological dead end. And I think the best example of that, or my favorite, has to do with food systems and the incredibly intensive energy appetite that the globalization of food systems demands. When you put all the pieces together, all of the energy associated with industrial agricultural production, which we're exporting around the planet, with packaging, processing, and distributing foods to market, you appreciate that we're investing sometimes as much as 10 times the energy into food production as we actually derive from eating it. There's no better illustration of an unsustainable model. We have tied the future of what should be a renewable resource, farmland, to a non-renewable resource, oil. So it may surprise you then to hear me say that I think this is a good thing. The WTO is a very good thing for us. And here's why. First of all, it shows us that revolution is possible. They did it without the benefit of any public support. Of course, that's how they did it. And based on a very simple, flimsy, and pathetically ludicrous idea, if it wasn't so powerful, and that is the idea that we can solve all of the world's problems if we only traded that much more. We should be inspired by their audacity. They brought about this revolutionary transformation in less than a decade. You know, all of this got underway in 1986, and it was almost complete in 1995. We can aspire to accomplish very much the same thing in the few years ahead of us now. The other reason that it's a good thing for the environment is that it's a very good model. The WTO is an excellent model for the type of comprehensive, fully integrated, binding international agreements we need to empower communities, to provide people, assure them with food security, to rise to the challenge of dramatically reducing the energy, the carbon intensity of development, to preserve biodiversity. It's exactly what we should be doing, simply in reverse. I sometimes joke that you can transform the WTO into an agreement for sustainable development by simply, at the end of every single line in the WTO agreements, putting the word "not." Now, it's a great model, and one of the best examples of this can be found in the Intellectual Properties Agreement, because unlike every other agreement under the WTO, which simply sets out a long list of things that governments can't do to regulate corporations in the public interest or maintain control of public resources or deliver public services, the TRIPS Agreement codifies a long list of things that governments must do in order to protect the intellectual property rights of foreign corporations in their jurisdictions. So I imagine transforming the actual language of the TRIPS Agreement into terms that would be specific to climate change. And if you did that, we would have an agreement that said to every nation, you must, as a matter of your domestic law, establish regulations and laws that will substantially reduce your emissions of greenhouse gases. You will allow us at the border to inspect and seize goods that are produced in ways that offend that objective. You will establish domestic enforcement regimes so that we can penalize those that aren't participating in helping us meet our global obligations. And we will impose trade sanctions against you, including cross-retaliatory sanctions, if you don't live up to your commitments under this agreement. And we must be saying to our governments, why is it that you take the profits of pharmaceutical companies more seriously than you do the challenges of reducing greenhouse gas emissions? Now, the third reason the WTO is such a good thing for the environment is that it's an opportunity for us to deepen our analysis. We have to get beyond the symptoms to the causes of unsustainable development. It's not about a particular pesticide or a particular park. There is no provision in the WTO that isn't about the environment. You know, the notion that somehow the economy and the environment exist as two distinct realities, and that's certainly the way in which the WTO would love to deal with them, is a pernicious, destructive idea that will defeat us in our efforts to establish an integrated economic, social, and environmental and ecological agenda. Look at every provision of the environmental agreement as if our ecological integrity depended upon it. The fourth reason that the WTO is such a good thing for us is that it has galvanized us. It has brought us together, women's groups, youth organizations, labor, Aboriginal, farm, environmental, culture, youth, seniors, churches, scientists, academics, poverty, civil rights. And did I forget to mention? Environmentalists need a social justice perspective on their work. Everyone needs an ecological perspective on theirs. We understand in an ecological critique, or we can discover, I think, the unifying themes of the new paradigm. And there are two that are particularly important. The first is limits to growth. You know, as much as the new priests of economic theology would ignore it, We actually live in an ecosystem which is bounded by finite limits. In fact, we've exhausted many of them already. And that's a powerful argument because it forces the growthers to confront the reality for the first time that they really have to deal with the issue of distribution. We will not solve the problems of the grotesque inequities between the way in which our world's resources are distributed between the poor and the rich, between the north and the south, between the corporate and the communal, between the present and the future, unless we come to terms with the notion that growth will not resolve those inequities. It's a powerful argument. The other unifying theme is the theme of diversity. Diverse systems are durable. They're resilient. They're the only systems that are sustainable. Monocultures are not. So let me conclude by saying that I really do feel that this is a watershed. This is an agreement that was created by stealth. It was very frustrating to confront this agenda, knowing what was at stake and how few people understood it. It can only survive while it remains in the back rooms, and others have said this so much more eloquently than I can. The best way to defeat an agenda that would muzzle us, that would take away our voice as a community and as individuals, that will punish us if we don't comply, is to use muscles that I think were, for many of us, at risk of becoming atrophied. And that is the exercise of democratic speech. And speak knowing that with each utterance, a beam of light shines onto an agenda that withers like a vampire when exposed to the light. Thank you.
That was Stephen Schreibman, Executive Director of the West Coast Environmental Law Center in Vancouver, Canada. He is the author of The WTO Citizen's Guide, An Ecological Critique of Globalization. Stephen Schreibman and Patty Goldman were recorded at the International Forum on Globalization teach-in on the eve of the WTO Summit in Seattle in November of 1999. You can get a 60-minute audio tape on the WTO and the environment that includes Stephen Schreibman and Patty Goldman for $12. Or you can get the 80-page transcript of the full series, The Day the WTO Stood Still, on issues of genetic engineering, privatization, water and food security, environmental impacts, and much more. That's $12 as well. For a credit card order, dial our toll-free number, 1-877-TUC-TAPE. That's 877-TUC-TAPE. Or send us a check to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's TUC Radio, Box 41009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. TUC Radio's website is www.tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.